The hope, done sensibly, is that the incentives for investment and economic growth will bring in enough growth and therefore tax revenue.
This is the Wintrust Business Lunch, sponsored by Wintrust, Chicago's bank, on 720 WGN.
Thanks very much, Jen DeSalvo. Steve Bertrand here. You're listening to the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WGN. Orion, if you're listening, we love you. We miss you. We've got some connection issues here, and I've got four engineers over my shoulder. So we'll have it hooked up and reconnoitered for the bottom of the hour. We'll check in with you then. Dennis Rodkin will be here in the second half hour. You know, I was gone for a while. Then we had White Sox baseball. I think Dennis was off, maybe. I don't know. But we've not been together for a month or so. Dennis will be here a little bit later in the program. But we'd like to start on Wednesdays with Terry Savage, who joins us on a phone line now. Of course, Terry from terrysavage.com, a personal finance expert, is going to set you straight. Terry, welcome back to the Biz Lunch.
Always love it on Wednesdays.
I know you like to listen to Orion's report, too, to get up to speed, so I'm sorry.
As long as we know he's okay, and it's just a connection problem.
He's fine. Yeah,
okay.
it was an issue here, so we're good. Hey, right. I sent you an article today from, it's from Citibank, right? Citi Research, and they have a bear market checklist. I think there's 18 items on it, and they say that it's sort of indicators of whether or not the market is about to slow down or go into a bear market. In the past, let me see, in 2000, 17.5 of the indicators were positive. In 2007, 13 of the 18 were positive. Right now, there are only, I think, 4 or 5 in their checklist of 18 that indicate a bear period coming. Only 4 it is. So we should rest easy, right?
You know, I'm not in the business of calling the turns, stock market timing. I'm in the business of advising people about risk management, which is an entirely different thing. But I've lived through some bear markets, and I remember especially the first ones being very surprised when all of a sudden something happened. 1987, that was kind of shocking. And although I had been thinking the market was way overvalued in 2000, and talking about, you got to be careful, for a year and a half too early, being really surprised, not so much, we can't even remember what caused the turn, but the one thing I remember about every start of every bear market is it plummets. It's dizzyingly sharp decline.
When it comes fast.
It does. You know, the bigger they come, the harder they fall, and they fall much more quickly than they go up. And I've had enough of that at this stage. You know, if I really, I don't know when the turn will be, and I sent you in return, a chart book of indicators about when recessions are coming. Those kinds of things are going around now because I've never seen, I honestly have to say, I've seen times when a lot of people were bullish and taken by surprise by a bear market, but I've never seen such confusion among all the would-be soothsayers. And I think what's different this time is this global economy, all the credit and liquidity that was created a decade ago, the fact that bear markets may come when everything's peaking, but Europe's really in the tank. They've got negative interest rates. Europe is slowing. America's the strongest place. And nobody can quite figure out whether the Fed's in control or not, or the markets are in control. I don't know how anybody can make a call. All I know is when I talk about the market and the percentage I want invested, and of course, I get disappointed if I've got too much in cash and the market keeps going up. All I know is I don't want to be there that day on the show.
Right.
And you will call me, even if it's not a Wednesday, and say, what should we do now? And could I please point back to the fact that if you're getting to the stage where this is it, you're not contributing anymore to your 401k or working, you're planning to live on it, maybe leave some to your kids. This is not the time to be overextended in stocks.
Yeah,
it's the longest bull market we've ever had.
Is that part of it? I mean, why people are so confused is because it's just gone on longer than ever, and this is maybe, I mean, is this an anomaly in so many ways?
Well, number one, we forget. It's like, any woman would have a second child unless God made you forget about childbirth. And it's sort of like the stock market. Investors forget. They forget the pains of a bear market. And
consumers do that, right? Because we're talking about credit card debt is right back where it was.
And credit card debt is back at the peak. Well, everybody vowed 10 years ago, I'll never get caught in that trap. But somebody is. because look at the credit card debt. So the thing is, we never seem to learn from history. We also have some unique circumstances this time. And some of the traditional signals just don't seem to be working, because if it were if you could judge the future by the past, you would have expected inflation by now. Europe's creating credit. I mean, they've got negative interest rates. The only thing that I'm looking at right now that portends that maybe we're getting back on the track of inflation is gold.
Hugh Dalio
wrote $1,423 an ounce today.
Ray Dalio was writing about gold today and about how it's going to be a big play coming up.
Well, we talked about this a couple months ago. I wrote a column about how to buy gold, but I was very carefully hedged. I said, you don't want to put too much in there. But what gold is signaling, I'm not saying that you have to buy gold, but what gold is signaling is something's not working right. Look, I get emails at the Ask Terry blog at terrysavage.com about, okay, I'm getting out of the stock market, I'm going to buy bonds. Okay, the question is, you can lose as much money in bonds if one of two things happens. The economy tanks and you've bought bonds that are of companies of questionable ability to repay, or if interest rates were to go up, which would happen with inflation. Nobody's even thinking about those possibilities yet. Half of the investment grade debt, so rated investment grade, so mutual funds and pension funds could buy, half of it is rated triple B, on the very edge of junk. There's some things, I know it sounds like sophisticated stuff, I'm just saying that don't push your luck.
All right, I want to ask you.
That's fantastic bull market.
I want to ask you about the Fed, because everyone seems absolutely certain that the Fed is going to cut interest rates later this month. There was a quote today from Chris Rupke, chief financial economist at MUFG Union Bank. He says, it just doesn't smell right given the strength of the economic data. The consumer is back in a big way. You really have to ask yourself, why are they going to cut rates? And so I'll ask you, if the economy is going well, if we are spending money, why are they going to cut rates?
I watched Jerome Powell talk around that point for hours on end in his testimony, saying, well, we're data-driven, and that's a week ago. We saw a little bit of weakness. I honestly think the markets were ahead of the Fed in anticipating a rate cut. And I think what happened is the Fed got a little trapped. If they didn't acknowledge they were considering cutting rates, the markets would have reacted violently.
Well, what happens if they don't?
That's going to be an interesting question. We've had, since last week, some strong numbers. The last person I'd want to be is Jerome Powell. I think they'll probably cut rates because they're trapped. But this will be the first rate cut since 2007. The idea is you raise rates or hold them steady in a strongly growing economy, and you cut when you see trouble ahead. I don't see where the Fed can see trouble ahead.
So what happens if they don't? Does all hell break loose if the market's already planning on it?
Yeah, I think actually the most interesting thing is that some rates are up a little bit since Powell can acknowledge that they're likely to cut. If you look at Treasury bills and Treasury notes, this is a 10-year Treasury, was under 2%, and now it's slightly over 2%. So after the Fed said it was cutting, so the Fed may be able to deal with short-term rates and affect them. But long-term rates, it's a little bit harder for them to control. So the 10-year note is now yielding 2.06%. The 3-month Treasury bill, I'm looking online now, is yielding 2.13%. That's better than most of your CDs are giving you. Although we can talk in the second half about how fine.
I want to take a break, and we'll talk about the personal interest rates coming up. Terry Savage is on a phone line. Terry, I think I'm going to call Prestige Exotics and rent a DeLorean. DeLorean, are they around? And come pick you up, bring you over here.
You know what? That'd be great. I'd love to go out and
love to see
any
you.
Hot sports car, because you're a hot guy.
Love to see you driving around. I think that'd be perfect. You should do that. Okay.
Let's figure out where we stand right now, because this is important when we talk about where we're going. Now, the Dow is down about 50, 27,282. The 10-year Treasury interest rate, 2.06, and gold at 1423. And I'm just going to stipulate that everybody's confused about where the market's going.
So,
but
in Europe,
let's set this up
in Europe,
everybody.
In Europe, if we had money to put in a savings account, right, we're better off putting it under our mattress. That's not the case here just yet.
No, you're not. You don't want to put it under your mattress. You do want to earn some money, and you do want the safety of FDIC insurance. But part of this confusion is people are getting really, I'm going to use the word, ripped off by many local banks who offer about 50 basis points, a half of 1% on a money market deposit account, maybe between 50 basis points and 1% on a one-year CD. And I know that a lot of people who are listening are not about to go running around town to find a different bank. Number two, you can search online at bankrate.com, but by the time you wire your money to an online bank, and if it's FDIC insured, there's some great ones, Alley Bank and so forth, they offer higher rates, but you take some time getting your money back and forth, and at the end you have to search again. So I am really excited about a service that's been around for a few years. I wanted to see how successful they were, and they are growing by leaps and bounds. It's called maxmyinterest.com. It's a website, maxmyinterest.com. And this is a really neat concept.
So tell me, who wants, so if I've got a couple of CDs coming due or something like that, I've got some cash I want to put somewhere, and I'm not getting a return on my local savings account, you're saying Go to maxmyinterest.com and they will find a better place for you to put
it? You're not giving them your money. You are linking your existing checking or savings account, signing up with three or four online banks. It's very easy to do because they have a common application. And every week they go through the rates that you're getting. And if they can move your money to one of these accounts that you've opened up, they give instructions to move your money to another large bank. They're working with all the large banks. And in fact, they're getting extra deals on rates because banks usually pay for marketing expenses to add new clients. So they've arranged even some higher savings account rates. Important to call, they call it savings accounts. It's not a CD because if you had to move it quickly because the rates went up somewhere else, you'd pay a penalty.
But, okay.
But these are savings accounts like money market type accounts, FDIC insured
at major banks. Like Terry, are there transaction fees? Are there costs to move it from account to account?
No, the cost is 2 basis points, 0.02% per quarter. So if your savings account is yielding 1.42, you pay 2 cents per 2 points per quarter. And you can take your money out anytime you want it. You can call up and say, I want out of this whole thing. Just please, all you banks, wire your money back to my account at, Chase or MB or whatever
it is.
So you read the column at terrysavage.com or go to maxmyinterest.com. It's a really benefit. A lot of financial advisors, this got caught on with many financial advisors who have clients' money, and they didn't want to take the time to search for people who got out of the market, left cash in their accounts, wanted to have the money under management. So the financial advisors started using it first. Now individuals, somebody's going to ask, there's no minimum. So you can open your account. You can go online and set it up, linking it just with your existing bank. They'll tell you which of the major online FDIC-insured banks they're using. And you just leave it to them to maximize the interest.
All right, give me the website one more time.
MaxMyInterest.com,
M-A-X. All right. Terry Savage, thanks for joining us today. I appreciate it.
You bet.
Go hit the pool, will you?
Next.
Thanks very much, Jen DeSalvo. Steve Bertrand here. It is the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WGN, sponsored by Wintrust Chicago's Bank. All right, there's a fellow sitting across the studio from me here who I used to know years ago. Bring that mic closer. We don't think we've been together for over a month or so, have we?
Oh, that's what you mean by you used to. I was thinking.
No, I'm not bringing up how you've changed dramatically. No, but it's been a long time
since
you've been here.
Yeah.
Okay, so let's talk church. Let's go to church.
Okay.
Because you've got a couple stories.
Bless you, Steve.
Thank you very much. One in Kenwood and the other in Logan Square about vacant churches that have been rehabbed for housing, which I guess probably isn't too unusual. I mean, it's happened before.
Oh, it's happening,
yeah.
Especially
but
in
bet,
the...
But if my point is, I think it's probably going to be happening quite a bit now.
I think more, yeah, certainly, because these historical buildings need care, right? And church attendance, as we know, is way down. And so if you want to protect this landmark, what, I mean, what else, can you put a grocery store
right.
in a church? But it's happening quite a bit on the in the sort of hot Northwest Side neighborhoods. This one, the big one we're talking about is in Kenwood. It took quite a while to make happen. There were a couple of plans that were floated and failed. But now the first units are complete and for sale. And it's kind of an interesting process because what they ended up doing there, originally, they were going, it's a an old Christian Science church built in the early 1900s.
I'm going to say Romanesque.
Okay.
Does that work?
Looks sort of like a temple.
Yeah.
It's got pillars on the front. It doesn't look like a church so much as like a scholarly place, and that's because it was Christian Science. And we can talk about how that came to be. But it was Christian Science, and then for over 50 years, it was the Shiloh Baptist Church. Closed in the early 2000s, and it's been empty. There have been all these plans. Most of them included keeping the whole building. All you really have to keep is the historical facade, the part that faces the street.
Did they by rule, by law? Was it protected?
It's a protected. Okay. The facade is a protected landmark. So the current plan, the one that's actually going through, the one the man is building and now selling, is to take, they took down everything but the facade. So you build new townhouses essentially right behind the old facade. Two of those townhouses will actually have pieces of the facade, pieces of that essentially that front porch of the church as their own, but it's all new construction from their back.
And so two of them are for sale,
right?
1.3, right? And the ones on the street will go for 1.7?
They'll go for a little bit more because they'll have these sort of these beautiful street faces. And it's sort of an interesting kind of a concept because, as we mentioned, so church attendance is down. That's not brand new. That's
right.
Been going on for decades. And there are all these buildings going empty. So what, in some cases, we've seen the sort of fun places that were done in the 70s and 80s where somebody lives in the choir loft and somebody has the big church floor. But, you know, if you want a sort of standard, for lack of a better term, standard living space, you want bedrooms and kitchen and that sort of thing, they're not going to be able to keep a lot of the sanctuary. They're probably going to do things like this.
Okay, so then let's go to Logan Square, where this is a church redevelopment in a churchier building.
Yeah.
And you have some of the pictures up of the interior, and it's still clearly a church. I mean, you know, they've kept the windows and things like that.
Some of which is done because of landmarking, right?
Okay.
I mean, on the front, it's required in if the church has been landmarked.
And so and is this one just under rehab, or it's already up for sale, the buildings? The apartments are up for rent?
This one has just resold. This is one where a developer bought the building, rehabbed it into apartments. Brianna Kelly wrote the story earlier this week, and then resold it at about twice what the developer originally paid.
Was after just a few years, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. What we don't know is the total that was spent to rehab, so it's not quite accurate to say the value is up double, but this, you know, this is a nice reuse of the building. What could have happened is the thing gets knocked down and you put up another placeless, faceless sort of a condo building,
right,
instead.
Exactly. No, I like that.
Yeah.
But looking at the interiors, you have to want to live there.
Yeah.
I mean, because you clearly are living in what used to be a church, I think, in some of them.
That would be a difference between these two
between
projects. One is we took down the facade and built new, so we had what I described as sort of a standard floor plan. The other is, you know, you have the choir loft and you have this and that, and that isn't always practical. I mean, I think part of what you do is you reduce the number of buyers, or in this case, renters, who would be interested, because most people are looking for kind of an ordinary floor plan, kitchen,
all right, so,
baths.
So while we're in Logan Square, then you also write about an apartment building and a quick turnaround, right? 1627 North Humboldt Avenue, sold for $2.78 million in 2015, and then just resold in June for $5.3 million.
Right.
Which is a huge profit in just a couple of years.
Which is not bad.
And Mark Fishman's the guy who bought it, right? The developer?
Right.
And he's not so popular in Logan Square?
No, because of exactly this.
I mean,
one of the questions with these kinds of developments is, you know, the people who've been here get moved out so that you can clean it up. And when you put it back on the market, it's coming in at a much higher rate. And that counts as gentrification. You know, we've got gentrification issues all over the city. This is one where you're in a neighborhood where people are already sort of attuned to this. Logan Square has been changing very quickly. This man has been one of those leverages of change. And so when he comes in and fixes this building up, yes, it stabilizes the building. Yes, it provides housing for people who are looking for a certain level of housing. But it also takes away the lower level of the lower priced housing that people were hoping for in the past.
Okay, so that's the story in Logan Square. We're going to take a break. When we come back, I want you to tell me a story about this house in Riverside, which is actually built on an old boathouse, and it seems like a very unusual sort of, well, it's a beautiful view, right? You can see the river from almost every window.
Yeah, it feels like it's in Wisconsin.
All right, take me to Riverside on the Des Plaines River. There's this home that was built on a 100 or about 100-year-old boathouse, and now it's for sale.
And now it's for sale. Yeah, it's, you know, the thing is, I could actually take you on the Des Plaines River to this house, Steve, the way you said it, because it is built literally on the banks of the river. No other houses along in there are. And as far as I can tell, no other houses within the suburban area are built that close to the Des Plaines
and
River.
And it's even built on a bend in the river.
Yeah, it's so Riverside has this, if you look at a map of Riverside, there's sort of this long finger of land. The Des Plaines River kind of takes a big U-turn, and it's built out on that. And on the other side, so it's on the east bank. On the west bank, the Cook County Forest Preserve owns miles north and south of there. So what you're really looking out at, you're beyond the other houses on your side of the river, and on the far side of the river, it's all trees. So it's like being in Wisconsin or some other.
So we should go in on this house and open up a supper club.
In the boathouse
at
the bottom,
I'm
for it. A paddle-up supper club. That would be a great new concept. It was, so it's not entirely clear why or how the boathouse was built. There aren't others. But it was built sometime between 1895 and 1905 as part of an estate in that part of Riverside. The rest of the buildings are gone, and the estate was subdivided. So this is really just on sort of a standard suburban lot.
So is this a theme? Was the boathouse protected as well? Or did they just decide to keep it?
I honestly don't recall the landmark status,
okay.
But they kept it because, somebody bought the boathouse in the 50s and built a ranch house on top. And then in the 90s, this man who's selling now bought the ranch house boathouse and expanded. So it's about a three-story house. It's pretty remarkable. You saw the pictures. It's got this V-shaped roof. It sits out because the boathouse is on
the water.
The house is out there. And so when you're asleep in the master bedroom, it's as if you're asleep on the river. With the windows open, you'd hear the water. Yeah, and he also told me that when he first moved in, when he and his now late wife first moved in the early 90s, the Brookfield Zoo, which is on the other side of the river, sort of behind that forest preserve land, they used to have their lions and tigers over in that vicinity.
Oh, and so, really? You could hear them?
Yeah, you'd sit out looking at the river, hearing lions and tigers. That's all been moved. They're in another facility, and he said he doesn't really hear wildlife anymore, but
okay.
Can you imagine?
One more I want to talk to you about, a single-family home, a Louis Sullivan home in Lincoln Park.
Yeah.
Only five left, right?
As far as I can tell, only five houses left. There are also five row houses and some apartments, but five houses by Louis Sullivan still stand in the city.
And this is on Cleveland near Lincoln Park.
Yeah.
And it's for sale, built in 1844, for sale for $1.95 million.
1884.
What did I say? 94?
1844.
Okay, but so I'm skipping way ahead to my favorite part of the story.
This
building was, I think, owned by an interior designer.
Uh-huh.
So she took a lot of the stuff out. But then I read late in the story that she gave a lot of the artifacts to this guy, Richard Nickel, who's just a Chicago story. But tell me about Richard Nickel and his tie to this house.
Well, she's not the one who gave it. She's the more current owner.
I get anything right about this story?
Yes, in Cleveland. In the early 50s, apparently, people were modernizing this 1880s house, and they got rid of a lot of the Louis Sullivan-designed ornament, the plaster medallions on the ceiling and that sort of thing. And they yanked it out because they were trying to make it look more up-to-date. And they gave them or sold them, I'm not sure which, to this man, Richard Nickel, who was collecting Sullivan ornaments.
He was sort of a self-proclaimed preservationist, right?
Yeah.
He would go into buildings being torn down
and take pictures of them so we would have that memory. A lot of people will tell you that he's how preservation got started in Chicago, because he's documenting these buildings that are being torn down in the middle of the century because we're modernizing Chicago. And he sort of said, well, hang on, look at what you just lost.
His death was kind of mysterious, wasn't it?
Inside a building that was under a demolition order, yeah. I don't recall the exact details, but yeah. He dies in a building he's documenting. And he has, before he died, he sold to SIU at Edwardsville his collection of hundreds of pieces of Sullivan houses, or Sullivan buildings, not just houses, including, apparently, these pieces from this house on Cleveland that have been removed in the 50s. So along in the 1990s come these owners. Jessica LaGrange is an interior decorator, designer, and redoing the house. She goes to the SIU Museum, duplicates some of the pieces that were removed from her house 40 years earlier, and installs the duplicates in her house, which I think is a wonderful sort of cycle.
Read about it at chicagobusiness.com. It's a story by Dennis Rodkin. Thanks for coming by.
Thanks, Steve.